Good evening. Lovely to see so many people here tonight. I came back from my 10th visit to Burma a couple of months ago, so I'd like to talk about some of my impressions, but also to begin with, to give a sort of perspective on where I think Burma and the subject of my book, Aung San Suu Kyi, are going in the process of these coming 2 or 3 years, which are absolutely crucial for Burma's future. The first time I met Aung San Suu Kyi was in 2002, when she had been just released from house arrest. And I was the independence correspondent in Delhi and jumped on a plane, got a tourist visa and went into Rangoon and interviewed her there. And at that time, I think it's fair to say that she was famous, but at the same time, almost completely unknown. She'd become famous in the course of a few months in 1989, when she basically created the National League for Democracy. Then she disappeared into house arrest in July of that year, and was really only glimpsed over a few months in the subsequent years. Since then, and in particular since her last and one hopes and also believes final release from house arrest in 2010, she's come much more clearly into focus. And I think it's also fair to say that she's lost a lot of popularity in the West. For a long time, until then, in the West, she was seen as a sort of saintly figure who sort of epitomized sort of saintly virtues, and who was willing to sacrifice the comforts of a conventional English life and her marriage and everything else. And all she got in return was years and years of house arrest. Since she came out of house arrest, she's evolved from being an icon to being a person who is determined to do everything in her power to transform the destiny of her country. In other words, she's become a politician who doesn't yet have any power. And in that process, she has lost a lot of the esteem of her supporters in the West because she is doing the sort of things that politicians do, making decisions which are practical ones. Nonetheless, I mean, I think that for her, this loss of popularity is not important. And I think what's interesting is that although it's 4 years since her release, nearly 3.5 years since her release from house arrest, she is still the most important figure in Burmese politics. And I would claim that future historians will regard her as the dominant figure in the development of Burmese politics since Ne Win, the military strongman whose decline led to her sudden emergence in 1988. She's often compared with Nelson Mandela and her achievement or her potential achievement compared with his achievement. I think of the many differences, the obvious one is that Mandela had an existing political party, the ANC, which was already potent. And although, as we know, South Africa was intensely racist, it was nonetheless a functioning democracy. When Suu Kyi suddenly emerged on the stage in Burma in August 1988, there had been no democratic functioning democratic culture in the country since 1962. And she practically single-handedly carved a democratic space out of that tyrannical culture, terrifying the military, who have basically been in a funk about her power and her potential ever since. And you can see that ever since her emergence, they have been attempting to neutralize, to contain, and if possible, to eliminate her physically. You saw this in right at the beginning of her career when she made her first speech, and the posters went up all over Rangoon, calling her a foreigner's whore, and basically sort of libeling her because of her marriage to Michael Arris, the Oxford scholar. That didn't stop her at all. She immediately became the obvious leader of the burgeoning democratic movement, founded the party, and barely 11 months after that launch, she was under house arrest and disappeared. That was the most lengthy and sort of the crudest attempt to silence her, literally by making it impossible for her to speak or be seen or to talk to her colleagues. That, of course, led quite quickly to the Nobel Prize and to her extraordinary esteem in the West. About a year after I met her in 2002, she had once again started travelling the country, and they actually tried to assassinate her. There was a quite deliberate and quite well-planned attempt to bump her off outside Mandalay, which was only foiled thanks to the incredible bravery of her driver. So that didn't work. She remained who she was, determined on her course. Then the next attempt to neutralise and contain her was the Constitution, which was passed by a very dubious referendum in 2008, and which tried to neutralise her in two ways. One way was to basically allow Burma to become what the military termed a disciplined, flourishing democracy, which basically meant a formal democracy with the military hovering above it, ready to stamp on it if it showed signs of behaving in an unruly way. And the other thing in the Constitution was a clause specifically put in to prevent her from ever becoming president, because it said if you a candidate had a foreign husband or wife or foreign children with foreign nationality, that excluded them from standing as president. And part of the story of the last 2-3 years has been an ongoing attempt to change the Constitution in various ways, including that way. She has put on the record several times that she wants to be president. At present, as things stand at present, she can't be. So that is one of this arm wrestling bouts that is sort of going on in Burma as we speak. And finally, the most recent attempt to contain her and to neutralise her extraordinary popularity is a declaration by the election commissioner that before the general election scheduled for next year, which will probably happen in November, candidates for parliament can only campaign within their own constituency, which is targeted clearly at the fact that, as in 1989 and as in 2012, when she led a very successful campaign for by-elections, she is a formidable campaigner on the stump. I mean, she has an incredible appeal. Just yesterday, the election commissioner seemed to be rolling back on that. So it's like an ongoing effort by the military, continuing now to keep her in check. And this is a reflection of the fact that she's powerful and that she's had a lot of influence. And so the next question I'd like to address is exactly what has her influence been on the way Burma is today? And the critics of Aung San Suu Kyi, both within Burma and in other countries, would say that she is to blame for the fact that Burma remains today the poorest country in Southeast Asia, very much underdeveloped compared to practically all of its regional neighbours. And she's to blame for that because she supported sanctions. And given her global status and her Nobel Prize and so on, her prestige, the fact that she was opposed to sanctions being lifted until there was democratic change basically inhibited the West from investing. It inhibited a lot of people, particularly in this country, from going as tourists, but it also stopped, arguably, it stopped the country from jumping on the escalator of development. The answer to that is that now you've got development beginning, and the only reason it is actually working is because it coincided with democratic reform. The reform was brought about by the ex-general Thein Sein, who is the president, and who, against everyone's expectations, began a quite dramatic process of reform soon after he became president in 2011. And this has changed the atmosphere and the landscape in Burma almost beyond recognition from when I went there during the Saffron Revolution in 2007 and in subsequent years. In those years, the only country which it really reminded me of was Albania under communist rule, where people were frightened to talk to you, frightened to give their opinions, where you felt there were spies everywhere, and you felt it quite rightly. To work there as an undercover journalist was practically out of the question. There was simply no way it was very hard to establish any facts or to make connections with people who could tell you things. Going back for the first time after the reform process in 2013, I was astonished and impressed by the degree to which Burma had changed. The freedom of expression was the most obvious one. The very turgid daily paper, The New Light of Myanmar, which always had a photograph of a general on the front page, normally opening a school or feeding a monk, had been joined by almost a dozen other daily papers, some of which actually reported the news, including bad news. People no longer were scared to say what they thought. Terrible things didn't happen to them. The special branch, who had been ubiquitous if a foreign journalist tried to find something out, they were still around, but somehow they'd lost their connection to the machinery of power. They would spot what you were doing, and they would fill in their notes, and they'd take details, but nothing would happen. Nothing bad would happen. Trade unions were legalized. Almost all political prisoners were released, including the most important and the most prominent ones. Ceasefires were signed with the Karen, who had been in a state of essentially in a sort of war with the Burmese state since independence. It looked like a wholesale transformation, and I was very impressed. But then I went back again 2 or 3 months ago, and it was interesting to see what had happened, because all the things I've just mentioned were still the case. There's something like 11 daily papers in Burma now. There is a much greater sense of freedom, and although you know there are problems with people being arrested in demonstrations and so on, but the climate of fear has really disappeared. But what's become apparent after 2 years of reform is that beneath that changed landscape, the fundamental realities of power within the country have not changed at all. Power has been with the military ever since General Ne Win staged his coup d'etat in 1962. The military have, formally speaking, symbolically withdrawn from politics, but the ruling party is dominated by former military men. And the economic power is in the hands of retired generals and the friends of the retired generals and the friends of existing generals. And just to give a couple of examples of the ways in which this continuity of power manifests. With the newspapers, which I've mentioned, being a newspaper man myself, it's of particular interest. And I assumed that with all these new titles springing up, the Burmese language, New Light of Myanmar, would be in the doldrums or possibly about to go out of business. But on the contrary, it's still, its circulation is buoyant. And that's because if you are a businessman and you're interested in new tenders, government contracts, licenses, public announcements, that's the paper to read. If you're interested in who's died, who's getting married, who's been born, that's the paper to read. Meanwhile, the other papers, the new papers, all of which sprung up like mushrooms, are fighting over a very limited advertising market, and lacking access to the privileged access to the organs of power, to the printing plants, the things which actually give a level playing field to the press, they feel that they are struggling. So they're not struggling anymore against rules which prevent them from coming out, but they are struggling to survive nonetheless. Another example, which in a way is more fundamental and potentially more dangerous, is to do with land confiscation. It's long been a fact that if those high up in the military hierarchy wanted to obtain land for some project of their own, it was a fairly simple matter to remove the people occupying the land and deposit them somewhere else and build what you wanted to do there. And this has not changed. In fact, my Burmese friends tell me it's actually got worse, partly because the legal system is still weak and there are no clear laws against this practice. And the other thing that's made it worse is that the foreign companies who are now beginning to come in rather slowly, there hasn't actually been an avalanche of foreign companies coming in because a lot of them have sent in sort of feelers and they've gone to have a look, a reconnoiter, but clearly there are a lot of reasons to make them cautious. But those who have gone in have taken advantage of the fact that the easiest way to obtain land is simply to boot out the people occupying it. And so there is a danger, which I think is actually a concrete danger, of the resentment, the quite understandable resentment of people who are evicted, being tinged by xenophobia as they see the foreign capitalists coming in to make money and kicking them off their land. One of the underlying problems of Burma, which the new freedoms have actually allowed to emerge, is this xenophobia, which was one of the features of General Ne Win's rule right at the beginning when he deported huge numbers of Indians who'd basically been born and lived forever in Burma. And he also sort of booted out all of the institutions like the British Council and the Ford Foundation and so on. There is a strain of xenophobia in Burma, a product of its very difficult colonial experience as a British colony. And you see this in anti-Chinese agitation in the past. You see it in the anti-Muslim movements that have been such a feature of the last couple of years. And if I were to identify one particular sort of danger in the coming years, it is really that of once again Burma being tempted to turn in, to reject the outside world. So essentially you have this situation where a lot of things have changed, a lot of things which actually impinge more on the literate part of the intellectuals than on the mass of ordinary people. And at the same time, the actual status quo that has existed for a generation has not significantly been changed. Next year, probably in November 2015, we will have the next general election. And so the question is, what happens next? Can the National League for Democracy, Suu Kyi's party, come to power? And if they do come to power, what will they do? Elections are a bit funny in Burma. They had an election in 1990, the year after Suu Kyi was put under house arrest, and her entire party was basically arrested, or the hierarchy of the party were all put in jail. And her party won it by a landslide. It was run very fairly. The military were so shocked by this turn of events that they pretended that it hadn't been a real election at all, that it was just a preliminary to a new constitutional consultation. And it was never, the result of the election was never honoured. In 2010, you had a general election. The week before Suu Kyi was released from house arrest, and I was actually deported from Burma shortly before that election. They were not keen to have foreign observers following the election because it was very dubious. There was an awful lot of cajoling of voters. There was voting in advance by civil servants. There was a lot of fear. There were people who said, I have to vote for the governing party, the Union Solidarity and Development Party, because otherwise I don't know what the consequences will be. I've been threatened. So the majority, which the USDP, which is regarded as a proxy party of the military regime, the majority they got was partly because the NLD refused to run, because they were so unhappy about the constitution, and it was partly because it was fixed. Now, we had by-elections in 2012, when Suu Kyi became an MP, which, like the election of 1990, were run with remarkable fairness, and international observers were very happy about the way they were run, and the National League for Democracy won 43 of the 44 seats they contested. So the probability is that the general elections next year will be run like the by-elections of 2012, because at this point, there is too much of Burma's prestige depends on them carrying out this election in a fair way. So I think one can expect it to be carried out fairly. But will the NLD win? I'd assume, because they did so well in 1990 and 2012, that they would win easily. But there's a constitutional lawyer I met in Rangoon in February who said, no, that's not the case. The USDP will win a large number of seats, partly through intimidation, because they have a lot of money for bribery, because they will win in the ethnic areas where the people feel vulnerable. Ethnic parties will win dozens of seats. If the NLD were to win 40%, that would be a pretty good result. So we're not looking forward to a landslide victory. We're possibly looking forward to, at the best, a coalition between the NLD and some of the ethnic parties. But supposing that that is the result we get, and in a way, whether or not Suu Kyi is allowed to become president, what can we expect to happen if the NLD come to power? And I think it's clear from what Suu Kyi has been saying all these years that some of the terrible flaws in the governance of the military regime all those years will be a priority. The fact that education, health, the legal system are so ramshackle and have been so starved of funds all these years will be a priority. Because the military regime identified the students as a source of protest, there was a conscious and sustained effort to keep the students down, to put the universities outside towns, to basically to keep the country at a rather low level of literacy, because that was made it easier to contain them politically. I've got no doubt that Suu Kyi would want to try and reverse that. At the moment, the Tat Mador, the Burmese army, gets a very large amount of the national budget. It's claimed that it's something like 20% of the GDP. And that would have to be brought back. But as we've seen, one of the reasons why Suu Kyi is not quite so popular in the West as she used to be is she's keenly aware of the power that the army continues to hold. And she will not be so rash as to alienate them with her policies. I mean, she will endeavour to keep them quiet, to keep them happy enough that they will not interfere. But those are all rather mundane things. They're obviously very important, but they are not sort of things to make the heart beat faster. I think if we look at a larger goal of what Aung San Suu Kyi might hope to achieve, her father, Aung San, has been the symbol of Burma for, one could say, the large majority of Burmese people since his assassination in 1947. In a very short time, he created the Burmese army. Despite having fought on the side of the Japanese, he managed to persuade the British that he was the best person to negotiate with. He negotiated independence. He was then killed before he could actually become the first prime minister. But he took an important step towards constitutional reform by resigning his commission in the army before entering politics, indicating that if you wanted to be a politician, if you wanted to rule, you couldn't be a soldier at the same time. And with an agreement called the Panglong Agreement, he managed to persuade some of the biggest of the ethnic groups on the periphery of Burma to throw in their lot with independent Burma. Not all of them. The Karen refused to have anything to do with it, but the Kachin and the Chin and the Shan and others of the minority groups signed the Panglong Agreement. And if he'd lived, I'm sure that he would have tried to implement the agreement, which would have created a Burma in which the different ethnic minorities felt they had an equal stake with the majority Burmans. Instead, for the last generation since Ne Win took over, basically we have had a paranoid garrison state where the minorities were bludgeoned into conformity. And I'm sure that if she was thinking of her legacy, Suu Kyi would want to leave a country where that was no longer the case, where the different components of the Union of Burma would actually feel that they belonged in the country, and that they shared enough in terms of values and history to work together with the majority and create a democratic country that actually functioned. So that is the prospect which possibly lies beyond the next election of 2015. And those are some of the things I will be talking about in my coming book. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Peter. I'm mic'd up. That was just so fascinating to get your perspective on recent events in Burma, and also for you to share your experiences when you visited so recently. I'd like to start by asking you specifically about Aung San Suu Kyi, and then maybe ask a few questions more broadly about the state of Burma. Obviously, writing your biography of Suu Kyi, you became very absorbed with her. And you wrote about her very principled approach to everything in her life, including umpiring her children's games. And you know, she never... Principle was very important to her. As you say, she's been criticised a lot recently. I mean, obviously, she could never have maintained her saintly reputation as a working politician. But she's been criticised for cozying up to the military and for her apparent silence, or at least reluctance, to speak about the persecution of minorities, of the Muslim minority. Is this political expediency? Is she compromising her principles? And are you surprised or at all disappointed by that?
Well, I think that lots of people, including me in the West, are disappointed in the sense that one would love to hear her say the obvious truth about the persecution of the Rohingya and of other Muslim communities. It's difficult to say this without sort of sounding like one's justifying, but her Achilles heel in Burma is her marriage to Michael Arris and her long residence outside Burma. And given, as I mentioned in what I was saying earlier, this sort of seam of xenophobia in the country, it is quite easily turned into an attack on her. There was a coincidence between her coming into Parliament, winning the election in April 2012, and starting to travel for the first time, to travel abroad, and the first attacks on Muslims in Arakan State, which people were expecting her to denounce, and she maintained this rather sort of creepy silence, which she's kept ever since. And I think that the reason is that, well, the two reasons. One is that she knows that the majority of the Burmese Buddhists are paranoid about Islam. That paranoia having been sort of stoked over the years by Buddhist teachers. And also that she is vulnerable to these slanders that she's not really Burmese at all. She's identifiable with these other aliens who actually threaten the state. So I think one can, without being happy about that silence, I think one can understand it quite well, given that her goal has always been very clear. Her goal right from the outset has been, it's in my power, possibly, to transform this country. So there's absolutely no point in taking a step which would scupper that.
And do you see in her actions and her comments since she was released from house arrest and since she was elected to Parliament, do you see her charting a clear course? Do you see her having a master plan, or do you see her reacting to events?
That's a hard question to answer. As I said just now, she's charting a clear course in the sense that she knows what she wants to achieve. She wants herself and her party to be in power to make the changes she feels are necessary. In the process, of course, she is sort of now amidst all these ex-enemies. She's actually in Parliament a lot of the time. She has to do what it takes to stay afloat, really, including going to Military National Army Day and sitting next to the head of the army. So she is responding to events, but always with that goal in mind. I think one of the ways, that on my most recent visit, I felt she had taken a good and a constructive turn, was that she is now actively seeking allies outside her party. She's made initiatives with the Generation 88, the dissident organisation, She's once again talking to the ethnic parties. I feel that she's probably realises that a coalition government is going to be necessary, so she's got to have allies.
She's been accused of a certain aloofness and an inability to delegate within her party. Do you think she's well advised? Has she got good people around her in her circle?
I should say that Roz lived in Rangoon for 2 years. When she's asking me questions, she's asking with great knowledge. There has been a perceived problem with Suu Kyi that she does not have... she does not talk to an awful lot of people. She doesn't have a kind of group of... She doesn't have a sort of think tank, or she doesn't have a secretariat. She doesn't have a number of experts who are ready to advise her on various different issues. And so that sort of sense of being rather kind of deliberately insulated from outside views and making policy by the seat of her pants, as it were, that has been... I think I've been the correct perception. I think, as I say, I think that's changing now. She is deliberately bringing people on board who were not in the party before, who are outsiders. And the specific person I'm thinking of is the lawyer, Uko Ni, who I met, who has never been in the party, but is probably the world's top authority on the Burmese constitution, and is doing everything in his power to get it to reform it, to change it, and he is now one of her close advisors. So I think maybe that phase is one that is hopefully over.
You talked about with regard to the military and with regard to who holds power in Burma, a certain continuity of power, despite what we felt after, you know, in the first months and years after 2011 was a huge change. My question is, we talked about, you know, Suu Kyi's master plan. Does the military have a master plan? Because it seems to me in some ways they might be sleepwalking out of power. I can't believe that they would do that. But for one thing, as you know, the equalizing of the exchange rates has been very important in Burma and has cut off access to a lot of funds for the generals for their own pockets. It was a way that they were able to salt funds away. And you say that next year's election should be at least superficially free and fair. And we've seen the by-election in 2012, which the NLD won almost every seat it contested. So that doesn't look good to them from my point of view. What's their plan?
Well, I think that explains why constitutional change has become such a burning issue on both sides. The constitution, which was drafted by the man who is now the president, Thein Sein, basically... is it designed to enshrine the military's power within a formal context of democracy, so that there is, if there is civil unrest, or if the democracy takes what they consider to be hostile turns, then they can declare a national emergency and they can take power again. It is a way of which they've been sort of seeking ever since Ne Win's sort of stepped down. They've been seeking a new way to legitimise their continuation in power, and the 2008 constitution does it. So I think that although Suu Kyi's right to stand as a presidential candidate is only a detail in the constitution, there are lots of other things about the constitution which are really... really important for the military and really important for Burma's democrats to change. Uko Ni, the lawyer I mentioned just now, points out that it is very, very difficult to change this constitution. You need two-thirds vote in parliament plus a popular approval in a national referendum to change some of them. So it's as close to impossible as it can be. So I think certainly Thein Sein, his vision of the way Burma would continue is so epitomised in this rather clumsy, in English, phrase, discipline flourishing democracy. So you have a democracy that performs like a democracy but does not threaten their interests, which allows them to continue making money. As you say, the change of the exchange rate was, for all of us who have been to Burma many times, one of the most overdue and important changes. I remember the first time I went in 1991, the official exchange rate was something like 7 chats to the dollar, and the actual informal, unofficial exchange rate was close to 900. Would that be right, roughly?
Yeah, I mean, I think it went between 100 and 200 times.
Yes.
It was
ounced by. So, I mean, that persisted literally until, 3 years ago. And it enabled the military to use whichever exchange rate worked best for them at the time and become immensely rich. And changing that was an essential step in normalising relationships with the West. I think the other thing, which I haven't touched on at all, and you haven't mentioned, but I think this other factor which was important both in the reform process and the reasons for it, and in the military's view of the future, is that, as in other parts of Southeast Asia, and indeed East Asia, China's growing power and wealth and strength are a threat. Their economic power on the border, and particularly in the city of Mandalay, but also elsewhere. One of the reasons that Thein Sein was willing to embark on the reform process was because he realised that was the only way to bring the counterweight of the West to bear on the situation, so that the Chinese would not have it all their own way.
Visiting Burma over the last 2 or 3 years, I mean, both of us would have noticed the dramatic change in terms of freedom of expression that you talked about. That's obviously the most sort of tangible or visible change of the last few years. But you also mentioned that a lot hasn't changed for Burmese people. And I think we can safely say that perhaps for a farmer in a remote rural area, very little has changed. But I wonder whether you think, I can ask you, what has changed, for example, for an urban graduate? How is his or her life different now? And what can they expect from the future?
Well, I think we're at a point where, for the urban graduates, the gap between expectation and reality is becoming a very frustrating one, because you haven't really seen the economy take off in the way that it's expected to take off. As I mentioned, you've had a huge number of foreign companies have come in to have a look, and a few of them have set up in business. But there are quite powerful reasons for caution, and a lot of them have just looked and then gone away again. And so you have not seen the sort of explosion of job opportunities which other parts of Southeast Asia saw at a similar phase in their development. So in the ways that life has changed for the urban graduates is that it's less uncomfortable. You can say what you want, but you cannot actually yet hope that your life, the living standards, will improve in any substantive way. So I think we're at an interesting turning point, a sort of crossroads where the reform process has to continue and probably accelerate if the economic situation is to improve.
So just one final question before we open up for questions from the floor. Burma, I think, always has held a kind of exotic reputation in the West as a very charming place and a place that that still retains this feeling of a bygone Asia. When you've returned over recent years, since the sort of economic reforms, and apparently, you know, there's more international investment and development, particularly in Rangoon, have you seen a certain homogenization of the city? And do you feel that Burma can retain a kind of distinctive charm?
Certainly it's retained it so far, but that's, again, partly due to the fact that a lot of the changes are sort of in the forms of promise rather than actuality. The worst thing that's happened from that point of view in Rangoon so far is an explosion of the number of cars on the road. So it's become much more like another Asian city in that it takes ages to get anywhere. There's been a growth in the sense that Rangoon is an extremely beautiful city, and a lot of the beauty is connected to its colonial past and the buildings that remain in greater numbers in Rangoon than in any other Asian city. And there is a movement, there's an organisation set up to try to preserve that heritage. A lot of Burmese would say, well, this isn't our heritage, this is British imposition. Why do we need it? Let's tear it down and build something of our own. But there are counter voices pointing out that the scale is decent and human, that the city has a unique character. It has an incredible amount of greenery, incredible amount of water. It's also a bewitching city. And if it were to go the way of Bangkok, which is conceivable, it would be a great pity. And one hopes, you know, that the countries that enter the development game late in the day will actually have the opportunity to look around and say, well, actually, we don't want to go that way. There must be another way. And there'll be enough voices and experts and people from outside encouraging them to take a different course.